This is The Guardian.
Today, the war the world forgot. Why is no one talking about Sudan?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
My memories of Sudan, particularly as a child growing up, was that it was an extremely peaceful place and actually even a little bit sleepy.
Nesreen Malik grew up in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. She moved away as an adult, but returned regularly and was back early last year to visit friends and family.
It was the last days of Ramadan, people were preparing for Eid.
There were lots of soldiers on the street, but nothing too out of the ordinary.
There was sort of increased activity. You could see that checkpoints were there for longer and people were a bit more jittery, but people are kind of used to that in Khartoum and life just rerouted.
There were rumours of tensions among Sudan's ruling factions, but almost no one, including Nesreen, believed that war was imminent.
Not only did it not feel inevitable, it was actually unimaginable.
We begin with some breaking news coming in from Sudan, where we're getting reports of heavy gunfire across the capital.
Even as it began, my main memory of it was everyone, including myself, thinking, well, this is unusual, but it's going to last maybe a day or two.
She was wrong. Last April, violence erupted on a scale few could have anticipated.
It felt like someone had flicked a switch and put a war filter on Khartoum. That was how quickly it happened. The city was standing, and then a button was pressed, and suddenly it was a war zone.
The fighting spread throughout the East African country with alarming speed. On one side, the Sudanese army, and on the other, a militia known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, with ordinary people caught in the crossfire.
Civilians did not have a dog in this fight. To this day, it has not turned into a civil war, in the sense that it has sort of drawn in huge factions of the civilian population. This is two armed parties fighting each other.
12 months later, Sudan is facing what the United Nations has called one of the worst humanitarian disasters in recent history, affecting about 25 million people. But with all eyes on Gaza and Ukraine, the plight of the Sudanese people has not made the headlines or the in-trays of world leaders. It's not prompted marches or celebrity interventions. As the bodies pile up, the world has looked the other way. From The Guardian, I'm Helen Pidd. Today in Focus, the forgotten war in Sudan. Nesreen Malik, you are a Guardian columnist and you've written extensively about Sudan, the country where you were born. And you most recently called in a column for The Guardian for the world to stop looking away from this current conflict. Can you just start by telling us what people are going through right now in Sudan?
It's been a year of devastation, displacement and hunger. What has been the predominant experience is a sort of layering of suffering, where you have an estimate of about 14,000-15,000 people killed, but that is nowhere near even just what eyewitnesses recount, and 25 million people in need of humanitarian aid and the largest displacement crisis in the world, according to human rights organizations. Entire villages are being razed to the ground and people have to flee or else are murdered.
My family is poor. We are innocent and we don't have anything. They came to us with weapons drawn. We couldn't do anything. They took me to a faraway place. They raped me and then threw me out naked. My family thought I was dead, but they found me naked and they took me home. My brothers were also killed. There was nothing else to do but come to Chad.
There's people who have been displaced in areas where there isn't a sort of built-up infrastructure. So they've had to move into refugee camps or actually had to move entirely into different countries like Chad. And then there's those who are stuck in the country who now cannot get access to food, shelter, or medical aid. So it is probably the largest crisis in the world right now on a humanitarian basis.
The UN says an estimated 3 million Sudanese children are malnourished, and a quarter of Sudan's hospitals are no longer functioning. Some 8.5 million people have been driven from their homes.
And are you in touch with family in the country at the moment? And what are they telling you about their living situation right now?
I am. And most people in my family have had to move 2-3 times across parts of Sudan. The state is essentially collapsed. People's jobs aren't running. People's income isn't running. So there's very few sources of income, as well as high inflation and obviously scarcity of goods in a war economy. So the second thing they're reporting is just finding it difficult to get their hands on basic food, medicine, and clean water.
And can you give us a sense of the scale of the violence?
So I'll talk about Khartoum here, which is where it started. The scale of the violence was huge from the very beginning. From when the first shot was fired to when Khartoum Airport was struck, it was a matter of hours. That's how quickly it happened. And then spread just throughout the city.
Army has started taking over many roads. When we tried to cross to our place, they started raising the gun. Then we ran away.
There were scenes within the first few days of sort of the military headquarters on fire, of airplanes releasing missiles on the main arterial road of Khartoum. And the scale then, as it took over Khartoum, expanded.
Can we talk now about the origins of this conflict? For people who haven't been paying close attention up to this point, can you help us understand how Sudan has unravelled to this point?
There is a long history and there is a short history. The long history is that Sudan, when it became independent in 1956, was taken over, or administration was handed to, a very specific combination of Khartoum, Northern and Eastern elites and the military, essentially.
The world has gained a new nation. The Sudan, for 58 years under the joint rule of Britain and Egypt, becomes an independent republic.
Over the past 60 years or so, that constellation of interests has ruled Sudan in a very centralized way and running an economically extractive type of government.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, in the process, marginalized and excluded much of Sudan's population and its regions from investment and even from political representation. And the result is that for large swathes of the country, there was simmering resentment and rebellion. And so these centralized powers did not particularly want to get their hands dirty in suppressing rebellion in other parts of the country. So what they did in Darfur, in the west of Sudan, is that they partnered with local Arab militias to suppress and violently put down any sort of political resentment or rebellion in the region. And those came known to be as the Janjaweed.
The Janjaweed soaked the ground with blood in Sudan's Darfur region from 2003 to 2008, killing thousands and inflicting terror. What happened then has been termed war crimes and genocide by the International Criminal Court.
They carried out mass killings, rapes, and torture as the militia hit back at rebels complaining of oppression by the Arab-dominated government in the capital, Khartoum. Millions suffered as a result, and to date, violence is still flaring up in the region.
The Janjaweed then kind of grew and coalesced under a figure called Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, widely known now as Hemeti, who was a kind of warlord that managed to integrate a bunch of these Janjaweed militias together and essentially blackmailed the central government by saying, if you don't support us, if you don't integrate us into the state, we will then turn on you and join the rebellion.
And so what was the result of that?
The result was that the Sudanese regime then paid the Janjaweed, formalized them, and turned them into basically an arm of the state. That arm came to be known as the Rapid Support Forces. The RSF then grew into becoming not just a sort of reluctant partner with the Sudanese army, but it became a sort of bodyguard for the Sudanese president at the time, Omar al-Bashir. And Omar al-Bashir's eyes and ears and muscle in the rest of the country at a time when Omar al-Bashir was feeling quite isolated and marginalized and economically embattled. Mm. In return, what Bashir gave Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo is that he gave him basically free rein over resources, very rich resources in that part of the region, particularly gold, which then the RSF took over, mined, extracted, sold. But very few people had an idea of the extent of the power that he was amassing, the extent of the funds that he was accumulating, and how he was creating not just an internal empire, but building relations with allies and governments outside the country that became very useful to him later on.
Reports say that Sudan's military has forced President Omar al-Bashir to step down, ending 30 years of rule.
And so tell me about the revolution in 2019. The dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir is toppled. You're watching this unfold. Did it feel like quite an optimistic moment? Did you dare to believe that the future of Sudan was going to be a better one?
It felt, I remember at the time, that it felt like a dream.
Familiar slogans from the Arab Spring are now echoing across Sudan. Peaceful, peaceful, they cry, their hands raised and empty of weapons.
Triggered by the rising, it wasn't just a political protest. It was a protest that sort of rebuked everything that not only the government had done for the past 30 years, but all governments had done since 1956. So it brought together culture and music and art and a sort of window of ethnic and tribal solidarity. It felt like not just a moment of political uprising, but a moment of existential uprising, of sort of all that was suffocated by this dark force of tyranny, suppression, and centralization. So it was more than just the optimism of this dictator stepping down. It was about the rebirth of an entire country.
At 44, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo is deputy head of the Transitional Military Council. He's emerged as the most prominent member of the group that ousted President Omar al-Bashir. And he's told protesters he's enthusiastic for democracy.
We want free and fair elections and for the Sudanese people to pick who they want.
So Bashir is ousted, and there's a feeling that the country might finally be heading towards a democracy. Like, this was just 5 years ago. How did things go so wrong?
That sense of optimism and hope was quickly dashed when it became clear that, A, the military that had stood behind Bashir had no intention of ceding power. So between 2019 and 2023, what happened was that those two powers, the RSF and the military, ejected civilians from power that were allowed in after the 2019 revolution. Mm-hmm. And then between them could not come to an agreement as to how to run the country and how to basically split the pie. And in 2023, the Hemeti, the leader of the RSF, had reached, from what I heard at the time, such a state of paranoia and distrust and suspicion of the army that their partnership essentially collapsed and the conflict started.
Well, we take you to Sudan next, where airstrikes continue to hit the capital this Saturday. Hundreds of people have been killed since the conflict began. That conflict, of course, putting the leader of Sudan's army, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his deputy-turned-rival, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, who commands the paramilitary rapid support forces, against one another.
Nisreen, you've explained how the current war is between the Sudanese army and the RSF, the rapid support forces, who used to be bodyguards to the old dictator. Are these two groups operating independently, or are there other countries who are funding them or influencing the conflict in some way?
There are outside forces that are not only influencing the conflict, but extending it. So primarily the United Arab Emirates, which Hemeti partnered with a few years ago when he lent them or basically sold them troops from the RSF to assist them in their war in Yemen. Right. He also partnered with the UAE by selling it gold that he mined from Sudan's gold mines and sold it to the UAE at preferential rates. And obviously has promised the UAE some sort of massive continued interest in Sudan if he prevails. So the UAE is extending the RSF a huge amount of support, financial and military. The Sudanese armed forces have sort of traditional allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. There's word now that Iran is becoming involved as well. So it's drawing in these sort of proxy influences that see Sudan as a very, if the side that they back prevails, see Sudan as a valuable security asset to have. It's very strategically located. Mm. Has a huge border on the Red Sea and very crucial port in Port Sudan. And it's also a country that has immense natural resources and agricultural resources and minerals. And so these outside influences are playing a long game with obviously no interest of how long it takes or how many people die, that if they bet on one party, they might strike big when that party prevails eventually.
Would you say is either side of this conflict actually winning?
So this is the most important element for one to understand how difficult the situation is in Sudan. Neither of these two parties has the power to overwhelm the other. Neither of these two parties can dominate the other decisively. They are at stalemate. It could go on for months, it could go on for years. At the moment, the tragedy of Sudan and the intractability of the war and the fact that it's continuing is because neither party is strong enough to win.
Coming up, is there any hope for peace in Sudan?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Nesreen, the picture that you've painted of the conflict in Sudan is just so desperate. And as you've said, it's really not at all obvious who is winning, if anybody. The US and others are pushing for peace talks between the RSF and the Sudanese army. What hope do you think there is that these two sides will be able to reach an agreement to end the war?
Every time there is a promising indication that some party or the other has managed to broker a meeting, neither of the two heads, the head of the army or the head of the RSF, make it. They don't appear and they don't send senior representatives. So there is absolutely no interest in peace. There is so much bitterness between these two parties, and it is existential for them. If the army prevails, that is the end of Hemeti, and it is the end of the RSF. If the RSF prevails, not only the army, but the entire constellation of interest that has ruled Sudan for decades is also vanquished. Mm. So it is existential for two parties that will literally now fight to the death before they can contemplate the end of their power journeys and the end of their kind of entitlement to power in Sudan.
The people caught in this emergency are almost completely invisible. Other devastating crises have overtaken the news from around the world. 1 year since the war broke out, Sudan is in a state of collapse.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think I've heard Joe Biden or Rishi Sunak mention it recently, despite the horrifying scale of this conflict.
It's not really a conflict that falls across Rishi Sunak's or Joe Biden's table in a way that would resonate with their electoral programs, yeah, with their domestic political interests. They've both got elections coming up. And when I speak to diplomats, they tell me it's really hard to get Britain and the US to focus on any kind of foreign situation at the moment because there's big elections coming up and they're very focused on domestic politics. And then Gaza happened and October 7th happened, and that just took up all of the foreign policy bandwidth. So Sudan gets nary a mention.
Other countries are busy with the rest of the world, but no one cares about poor countries. That's why we're suffering, to be honest. We hope that people will stand with us, but neither the Arabs nor any country has helped us.
My recollection of growing up in Sudan was that it was just really off the beaten path politically. It was either sanctioned and punished and isolated for the actions of its government and just kind of consigned to darkness for years and years, or it was considered to be something too complicated to engage with.
And I know that there are some journalists who are managing to work on the ground there to report back to the rest of the world what's going on. Do you know what conditions they're having to contend with to get this story out?
It's very difficult to move around for journalists because the RSF militia is very hostile to reporters. And also the military side, which is the side that has allowed journalists in, is obviously very cautious about what journalists are allowed to see. So even when there is reporting, and some people have managed to get in and contended with very difficult circumstances, sometimes in live exchanges of fire, still can only do so for a limited time and have to leave. The consistency of the reporting is what is missing. The sort of the images, the footage, the narrative making of what is happening is missing from Sudan.
And I guess conspicuous also in their absence maybe is any celebrity intervention. I think quite a lot of us, when we think of Darfur, might immediately think of George Clooney, you know, who 2006 did, I think, spark global interest in the war that was going on there.
Well, this is not a conflict that is attractive to people like George Clooney. It is not a conflict where there is a very clear David and Goliath narrative. It's not, as in the past, framed as Arabs attacking Africans or Muslims attacking Christians. It is the falling out of two incredibly powerful militarized bodies that cannot be presented in a way that is compelling and attractive and sort of sexy for the global advocacy community.
Et au total, nous pouvons annoncer que plus de 2 milliards d'euros seront mobilisés en faveur des femmes et des hommes du Soudan.
So Emmanuel Macron, the French president, last week announced that world donors had pledged more than 2 billion euros in aid for Sudan, less than half of what many experts think is needed. How likely do you think it is that this money will actually be able to reach the people who need it most?
It's very difficult. Sudan itself at the moment, there's no front line. It's sort of a series of front lines. So just getting the aid through, getting the military or the RSF to allow passage of it, negotiating safe routes, that's all very difficult. And for it to happen in a way that is meaningful, there needs to be at least a basic agreement on the part of the warring parties that aid and humanitarian assistance can get through. They cannot even agree on that. That is the sort of intensity and level of vitriol and animosity between these two powers. So there are two issues. One is that there's actually not that much aid being pledged. I was speaking to members of a United Nations organization a few weeks ago who are extremely alarmed at how their contributions to Sudan have fallen instead of risen over the past year. So it's not only about getting whatever aid is pledged in, it's also about raising enough money for Sudan. And that's just not being raised at the moment.
And is there anything that gives you hope as someone who has not taken their eye off this conflict over the past year?
I have little hope of the military situation resolving soon, but I have hope for the Sudanese people, because one thing that's been really remarkable over the past 12 months, and actually is a continuation of a dynamic that has been happening for several years, is that the only way there has been any semblance of life, the only way that things, even though they're bad, have not devolved into even more catastrophe, is that people help each other. I have a relative who was fleeing from one village to the other, their car broke down, and the RSF was literally on their tails. And they just went and knocked someone's door and were taken in, were given a meal, spent a few safe nights, and then left again. That is a common experience throughout the country. So there is a sense that even as the sort of physical infrastructure collapses, the spiritual infrastructure, the sort of soul of Sudan becomes more clear. Its contours become clearer, and you see that actually, even as it looks like our homes and our universities and our schools and our playgrounds and all the things that were these building blocks of life and all our belongings and everything that kind of made life in Sudan what it is, even as all that disappears, something else that is much more elemental appears, becomes clearer and stronger, because the more that is eliminated, the more the spirit and the kind of texture and determination and what makes Sudanese people Sudanese becomes much more defined.
Nesreen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Nesreen Malik, a Guardian columnist whose work on Sudan has just been shortlisted for a European Press Prize. You can read it all on theguardian.com. That's all for today. I'm Helen Pidd. The producer was Eli Block. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo, and the executive producer was Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.